accession number 28413, Reel 5.
Mr. Sowler, Reel 5. We're in your first Indian camp, in effect, Indian army area. The food, you say, was still British.
Yes, British.
Rations. And there were you didn't have any natives who were working actually in the camp itself?
None at all, no.
So the cooking, etc., was done by the British army, in effect.
Yes.
But was it a very big camp?
Fair size, yes. I should think there was probably several hundred. It was only a holding unit. But Mao had one very, very useful thing. He'd had an engine shed. Whether you were supposed to go to the engine shed, I don't know, but I walked down to it. It was just a fair walk. Nobody said no, and while no one said no, I carried on. They were very friendly down the engine shed. I used to ride up and down the shed yard on the engines and quite enjoyed myself. Used to go down there quite regularly. It filled your time in. It gave you another interest all the time. The thing that struck me most was the fact, on a night, you felt it went on and on and on. Whichever way you looked, there was land for a long, long way, and it was dark.
So the nearest habitation to you would be this rather dirty village?
Yes.
What about the health situation as you got there? And I know you've just arrived, in effect, but the heat itself and the dirt, etc., was that affecting the British troops at all?
No, I was disgustingly healthy. I'd been pretty fit when I started. The first thing to do was to get rid of the Bombay boiler. Kicked about a bit, it soon looked battered, and you could get a decent topi from the store. Light, much more effective. And it didn't look as though you'd just arrived. So there was very little to do. We spent a lot of time picking stones off the football pitch, which usually used to last about 20 minutes before everybody disappeared into the canteen alongside the football pitch. And that's where I learned to play a form of bridge. I say a form of bridge, I think a bridge player would curl up at what we used to play. We did very little. One of the things we had was sort of a map reading exercise. We were taken 17 miles out by a truck, tipped off with a compass and a map, and said, find your own way back. It was difficult because it was scrubland and you could get no view because the scrub was about 8 feet high. Four of us in the group, we ploughed along, and we came on the map, which was dated 1922, was a river. We looked, there was no river. And we stopped and considered it, and then it penny dawned on us, it was completely dried up. So we walked across it, and we eventually found what must have been an old fort. We sat on the walls of that, and I had something to eat. There was a gateway into it with some very dark pieces on either side, which you didn't go into on account of the fact there may have been snakes in. So we pressed on and eventually came to an area which was all ravines. Provided you kept out of those, you were all right. We managed to get round those and eventually came to a place called Patalpani, which was a waterfall about a mile and a half from the camp, and over the railway. Once you'd got to the railway, you knew you were all right. Carried on, we got back. All the lots got back all right, apart from one that they had to send a search party out for. They also tried an assault course. Part of the assault course was you had to climb up onto a latrine block, run along the top, it was just a square block, and jump off the other end. I'd never been very good at jumping down, so I waited till no one was looking, and instead of running along the top and jumping down, I just ran round the side and joined the queue. And the man after me jumped down and broke his ankle, so I thought, well, good reason for not doing it. And life, pottered along, as it does in the army. And
but holding units are notorious for sheer boredom.
Oh, yes. So we had a trade test. Now, Vic and I were the only people with line instrument experience. And Vic made a mess of trying to mend a fault on a radio which we were given. The others were all quite brilliant on that. What happened to them? They were all sent to Burma. So Vic was suddenly posted off down to Ceylon. This would be March, April 44. Picking stones up on the usual thing off the football pitch, somebody came up to me and said, "You wanted at the company office." Your heart always sank when they said that. Went along, and they said, "All right, here's your movement order. You're going to replace Vic. He's disappeared." So, got all my gear together and drove me down to the station, got the train. I knew I had to go down to the junction at Candwa and pick up a mainline train there. When we got there, I could see in the darkness the mainline train coming into the station, see the lights on the train. We pulled in on the meter gauge side because it was narrow gauge. Nobody on the platform to ask, not a soul. So I got on the train, I thought it must be the right one, hopefully. And the rifle was a damn nuisance. You were always worried in case you lost the wretched thing. We went to a place called Itarsi.
Were you on your own at this point?
Yes, oh yes. I mean, the journey was about just over 1,700 miles, you know. And got off at Itarsi, found a hut with a bed in it, a charpoy, which somebody told me afterwards was bug-ridden. Never bothered me, though. Slung my mosquito net up and slept. Went to the station, had a breakfast at the station, and picked up another train at Itarsi, hopefully. I was on that train for a couple of days or so. It was quite an experience, actually. Nobody said how you managed to eat. Getting tea was all right. You stuck your mug out the window and said, you know, ek pia let ya. But we ate bananas and oranges and things like that.
And this was like a lines of communication, presumably. You were passing through British-controlled... Well, it must have been told by the army which stages to follow, if you're on your own like that.
No, the next thing I knew was I had to change trains in Madras.
And how you had to find that out for yourself, had you?
More or less. You went along by, you know, by guess and by God, a lot of it.
You're seeing a lot of India, obviously out of a train window, but you're seeing a lot of India. And what was your impressions of the country?
It was warm. It was slow. It was marvellous. I liked it. We were due in Madras at about 7 o'clock. And in due course, we pulled into Madras. And I had to get a train out of Madras Egmore, wherever that was, at 7:30. Found a rickshaw, piled all my stuff. There was my bedding roll, my tin box, the rifle... A wretched rifle. And he said, "I know Egmore." Off we went, Teekai. And he padded away, arrived at Egmore. Absolutely dead as a doornail. Not a soul about. Walked along, there was a train stood in. Thought, well, must be it. Nobody to ask. Tried the doors, all the doors were locked on the coaches. Found an open window. Threw all my gear in through the open window and climbed in after it. Went into the compartment, there were 6 RAF blokes. I said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I'm going down to Ceylon." Well, they said, "You know, this is full." I said, "I'll tell you what we'll do. Provided you don't mind the cockroaches, we'll pull this thing off the seat and you can sleep on that." Well, suits me. So I said, "Don't forget, stay awake for Trichinopoly. You get jam and bread and a cup of tea there if you're awake. You get there about 3 o'clock." So I got the right train, and off we went down to Ceylon. By this time I'd got the hang of things a bit better, and I spent quite a bit of time riding on the engines. One of the problems they had was that people used to come from the villages wanting water off the engine. And eventually we arrived down at Danascody, which is where they put the ferry leaves for Ceylon. Got on the ferry, across we went to Ceylon. Must have got there 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. Sat with all the gear, nothing happened. Another hour passed, still nothing. Oh, I thought, I'm fed up with this. Collected all my gear together, walked down the gangplank. I could see some coaches stood. I thought, well, that must be the train. You see how much by guess and by God it was. Climbed in, went to sleep. Eventually, everybody off the ferry started coming along. They'd been waiting for the customs. Nobody told me. Got in and went down to Polkawheeler, changed trains there, and it's a very rough ride from Polkawheeler up to Kandy, where I was going. And of course, who was the very first person I saw as soon as I got to Kandy? Vic Towie. I said, I'm here to relieve you, to replace you. You've disappeared. Oh, I said, that's all right. They just sent me to the wrong place. Typical again.
What were your first impressions of Ceylon?
Very pleasant. Very pleasant. Green. Mind, it must have been near monsoon time because it was pouring with rain. Yes, I liked Ceylon.
What was the monsoon season? When did it appear?
About this time of the year.
But August, September. So what happened to you then when you got to Kandy?
Well, they said, what we'll do is, we'll send you to where Vic Towie had gone to, and Vic Towie will take up the place he was at, you know, that he should have been. So I went to this other unit, and I was there over 2 years, and they were never sure whether I was transferred to them or whether I was just on loan.
Well, didn't the unit have a name, number?
It was the 11th Army Group.
And what was it, headquarters, or what you were attached to?
Yeah. HQ. So, anyway, life was reasonable there, and I actually had a week's leave in Ceylon, in Colombo, in July 44. And you can imagine what I spent most of my time in Colombo doing. I walked to the shed at Demeter Gouda and spent quite a bit of time going around the engine shed.
Did Colombo impress you as a colonial city?
The engine shed did. You can tell the way my mind worked. It all filled in time. It was all of interest, you see.
Was there you've mentioned the countryside being green, etc. But was there a marked difference between the two populations of India and Ceylon?
Never noticed.
Were they friendly?
Yes. Never found any problems. That came later.
So when you were with the unit, what exactly were you doing with the
unit? All teleprinters. And, excuse me a moment. I had this week's leave in Ceylon, in Colombo. And everything went on quite happily. Kandy had an engine shed. Wherever there was engine sheds, there I was. And it would be about 4th of November. We were told, pack everything up, you're going north. We're going up to Calcutta.
It's back to India again. Mm. Before we move on to there, you were with the 11th Army Group. Now, what army group was that? Was that just for the defence of Ceylon, or did it cover a wider area?
Covered everything. 14 Army Group, the lot, I think.
And you were maintaining and
teleprinters.
Mm. Was there a lot of work to do?
And at that time, it was quite reasonable. And cipher machines.
What was the situation going on around you at this time in India itself?
Well, that was the time when they were fighting at Kohima, across the tennis court with the Japs.
Were you getting information about what was happening?
Not really. No.
The camp itself that you were on, was it a purpose-built one? Or?
More or less, yes. It was quite reasonable. Sort of straw huts made with palm leaves and that sort of thing, you know.
And you were living in those?
Mm,
yes. Were the insects a pest? Were you find them difficult?
Only on one occasion. We were absolutely covered with white ants. You couldn't see from one end of the billet to the other. Somebody said, put some newspaper on the floor and set fire to it. And you know, they all flew into it. The place was clear in seconds.
What were you lying on? Beds?
Charpoy. Which of course was a wooden frame with the rope across, you know, and you had a blanket, sheets. No pillar, and the army never seemed to provide you with a pillar.
What was the sanitation situation?
It varied. Some places it was just a hole in the ground. And that was horrible. Because it was always full of blue bottles. In general, it wasn't bad.
Were the natives working in the headquarters area?
No, none. Not one.
Well, you mentioned it was an army group headquarters. Mm. Your element in there, your signals element in there, did it have a title or a number at all?
Not that I know of.
Who was in command of your particular group?
That is funny, because we had a lot. We kept getting a new CO regularly. It used to annoy them, because being in the signals, we got to know first that they were being chucked out and somebody else put in their place. It didn't please them.
Did you ever know why you were getting changes so often in that way?
I think that comes as we go on. I'll come to that, if you don't mind.
And as I say, you were talking about at least you were doing maintenance work on your teleprinters mm. and so forth. Was it an efficient unit?
Very. And everybody was keen. The one thing, that the whole the time I was there, the unit was very keen to make sure everything ran according to plan. They worked to the limit of their capacity.
That's a vital area of work, isn't
yes.
it?
And they were so keen. However, come November, we had to go north. 10 days on the train. You imagine how that appealed to me. We went to Trichinopoly, where, again, change of gauge, everything had to be transshipped. We were told, we won't need you for the afternoon, you can go off. So you can imagine where I went. Walked down the track, went to the engine shed. Very interesting. Southern Indian Railway engines. And by this time I got very used to Indian railways. Drivers were always very friendly, you could always get up on the engine. And actually got to one place, and a 14 coach. We were put on the back of a troop train, there was only 3 coaches of us. Don't know what had happened to the rest. And it was 14 coaches, because I know I was driving the engine. I bet they'd have had a fit if they'd known. Drove the engine for about 12 miles. Managed to stop it in the station within 3 feet of the water column, which I thought was quite good. And spent my time hopping up and down on engines. And boy, they do ride rough, and some of them. One of the chappies that came up on me one time I was there was a ex-infantry bloke, and he was only too glad to get back off the footplate, because they'd jump and shudder and bang. I enjoy it, but he didn't. He couldn't get away fast enough.
Was this a major unit move? Or
yes.
Just a few?
This was the major.
Was
this was the army group. So after 10 days, of this, riding on engines. As you can imagine, I wasn't exactly at my pristine best. Sergeant Major wasn't very pleased. I mean, you can't ride on an engine all that time and still look, you know. So we got to Calcutta and we were sent to a place called Barrackpore, which is about 15 miles out. We were in the grandstands of what had been the race course. There was charpoys there. Threw all my gear onto it, shed the charpoy. Before I had the time to unpack it, to anything, they said, we want two lines to Delhi immediately. Leave your stuff. There'll be a transport up to the signal office so you can start. Went straight up to the signal office. There was only about four of us, I think. And the teleprinters were in, looked like big tea chests. They'd been pushed around India that long, that whereas they had sort of angled legs with them moving backwards and forwards slightly in the boxes, the bolts had sheared off. The teleprinter has a return, a carriage return, and somebody had put a little bit of paper in to stop them from sliding about. And by that time it was in so tight he needed a piece of wood and a hammer and a drift to get them out. Then, to our surprise, we found there were mains units, and we'd always had a battery up to that point. No diagrams, nothing. So that to send somebody post-haste down to Calcutta to the unit down there to pick up circuit diagrams. So we got the circuit diagrams and we worked on until, oh, it must have been 10 or 11 at night, got the two lines through to Delhi, which we thought was quite good, actually. Everybody was quite happy. And that was the beginning. The unit there, it had between 10 and 12 teleprinters. It was quite something trying to work there, because lines would go out to some place or other, and trying to listen to over an ordinary Indian telephone line to somewhere like Guwahati, what's the matter on the line to you, with all the noise in the background, was pretty grim.
When you say putting a line out, what exactly do you mean? I mean, you were plugging into some system, were you?
Yes,
yes,
we had to balance all the lines so that it would work, you see. You had to make sure that, you know, you had a balance so that so it would transmit. And these operators were extremely good. They didn't like a teleprinter to go out of action. You know, you worked, you really worked, keeping them all going. I enjoyed it, quite frankly. It really kept you on your toes. We had a workshop at the end of the signal office. We used to try and maintain one particular teleprinter every so often.
Like a service situation,
yes.
You had to service them.
Mm. The big trouble was, everybody, I say, was working, I think, to the limit of their capacity. They were taking shortcuts where necessary, where they felt it was necessary. And then suddenly they wanted to start playing soldiers. Now, it's a difficult situation when people are working to the limit of their capacity and you want to start piling other, what they consider, irrelevant things onto them. So, what happened was, they decided, all right, we'll work to rule.
Well, can I just ask you, what additions were they piling on you? What were these additions?
To play soldiers.
What do you mean, drilling and this kind of thing?
Yes. And parading for getting on trucks and things like that. Oh, minor irritations. And the work to rule lasted 24 hours.
That must have been a pretty dangerous thing to do in the British Army, to say you're going to work to rule.
Well, they didn't say they were work to rule, they just did. That's the point. They did according to what the orders said they should do. You see, for taking signals over radio, you should work on R5.
Which is, what's
reasonable sound, so that, you know, you're sure of what you're getting. Well, they were quite happy to take it on twos and threes. And two or three of them had round one set to make sure they got the full thing. They were working. People were working. They were keen. They were working, and they were just being. It was unnecessary. So this major, we were in the, all called into the naffy, the big hall. This major came in, took his crowns off, and said, "All right, what's the beef?" Told him, "All right." All these minor things were cleared off. Everything went back to normal. I mean, if you could have seen the way these people worked, it was really amazing. They were very, very keen. We lived a life completely isolated from everybody else because we worked a peculiar shift system. Who devised it, I don't know.
What was that?
We started at 1 o'clock on an afternoon till about 5 or 6 on a night. We then went back on at 10 at night till 8 next morning. We went to bed, got up and did the morning shift, and then we filled in the evening shift. So, you know, we did 24 hours out of 48, and then supposedly 24 hours off. And there was always plenty to do. I mean, you got all sorts of odd jobs. I mean, one New Year's Eve, this would be New Year's Eve 1943-4, suddenly the whole of the camp went out. The lights went boing. And I was the instrument mech on duty. You know, do something.
Well, this would be 44-5, I think. 43-44, you were around the Salon area and coming out, weren't you?
That's right. Yes, it would be 44-45. Yeah. The New Year's Eve for 45. And went along. Substations are certainly not my cup of tea. It was a three-phase substation. All I had was a torch and a screwdriver and some loads of wire. Went in, and the three phases should have been equally balanced. One was carrying about 4 amps, the other was normal, and God alone knows what was on the other one. So I thought, take a chance, picked the thickest piece of wire I could find, switched everything off, put it across the terminals, pulled the switches again, all the lights went on. Marvellous. Of course, you got no thanks for that. You know, that was you were expected. So, it wasn't easy working in Calcutta.
There was a great demand on your time, obviously.
Mm.
Would this be due to not only to the essential elements of your work, but to the fact that there was so much going on in the war itself in India and Burma? Was it a great pressure due to...
Yes, to some extent. To some extent. That probably affected them more on the cipher machines, I don't know, but...
Had you been promoted by now?
That was the thing. The war establishment was one instrument mechanic signalman. There was no promotion. Whatever you did, you got no promotion. That's why I ended up a signalman. And Calcutta was difficult. I mean, it could go down as low as 40 on a night in the winter, and in the summer it would go up to about 125 during the day. You know, trying to sleep through that wasn't very easy. When I did have time off, you can imagine what I did. I got the local train down to Calcutta. See the trains. It's amazing what that hobby did. It really sort of kept your sanity.
Yeah, but relieved the tension on you.
Oh, it was marvellous.
What about your health through this difficult climate?
No trouble.
Were men going down with malaria and diseases?
Not in our lot. They were coming out of Burma. Because I know somebody went into hospital and they transferred him some miles away because they were bringing people out of Burma.
So yours was obviously a healthier area.
It wasn't healthy, it was just a case we had to be fit. And you kept fit. And everybody, as I say, they really did work hard. It was incredible, really. I mean, it was a case of, you know, talk about esprit de corps and all that, it was marvellous.